Welcome once again, folks, to allthingstrek.com. I'm Bob.
And I'm Oren.
So,
yeah.
Podcast UGC,
uh-huh.
As some of our listeners may or may not be familiar with them, they're an STO, Star Trek Online, podcast that deals with the Foundry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been listening to them. They're pretty neat.
And we're going
to
have them on.
Yeah.
Not today.
But later.
But probably next week.
Hopefully next week.
We're still kind of playing it out, feeling it out, seeing what schedules will work and whatnot.
We're sending telegrams back and forth. None of this instant communication. We don't do that kind of thing anymore.
It's like this thing, like the internet.
No, we don't deal
with
that.
Don't use that. Use snail mail, for instance, for that.
We used to have a holo communicator, but then the special effects team said no to that one. So we're not allowed to use that anymore.
Sad.
All right. And I want to remind everyone that we would love to get some feedback from you, allthingstrek@hotmail.com. And normally this would be the point in the show where I would talk about Star Trek RPG, but there isn't one anymore, which is making me a little sad, even if it has freed up my Sunday.
We actually have no gaming right now on our Sundays, do we?
Well, Jim is going to start one, but you're not going to be in it because you have a job now on Sundays.
I do.
And I'm starting a game next week, which is a Pathfinder game that someone else is running, which is... Pathfinder's not my favorite system in the world, but I figure it's time to try something new. And I just don't want to run anything right now.
It kills me when you say, I want to try something new, and it's Pathfinder. It's just 3.5, but better.
Yeah, it's
I want to try something new, but it's not that new.
Look, it's new to me, okay? I don't like 3.5. I've never liked 3.5.
And you're not going to like Pathfinder.
But Pathfinder is, like, polished 3.5, so it's, like, I still don't really like it, but I can at least respect it a little more. Like, I still disagree with its underlying mission statement, but at least it's competently done.
Speaking of D20 games.
Oh, yeah? What about it?
5th edition for D&D is going to be coming out, right?
Yeah, and they did this big whole thing where they announced it was going to be open playtesting and made a big hubbub, and then we have to wait till 2013 before anything comes of that.
Well, I don't have a problem with that, but I was chatting with a friend of mine about it, and he's got a little inside info.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it okay for us to be saying that on the air?
Well, I didn't mention his name.
Okay, that's good. Friend, with quotation marks.
Yeah. apparently what they're trying to do is make it open-ended enough that you could use any previous edition of D&D.
Really?
And, like, mash it together if you wanted to in 5th. So if you want elements of 1st and 3rd, like, together, you could mash it together.
I'm having a really hard time imagining what that would look like.
So was I when he was explaining it to me. But it's supposed to be modular in design.
Huh. Okay, so now I'm just imagining D&D 5th edition, and it's going to be split into 4 chapters, and it will be 4th D&D 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th all in one book.
Oh, it's supposed to include AD&D as well.
Oh. Isn't that just like AD&D? I get really confused about the different editions before 2nd. Okay, anyway, that's weird. I'm even more confused about 5th edition now than I was when like a minute ago. But, all right, so done with that.
Again, I have no way to confirm this info, mind you, but this is information that I've come across.
Yeah, okay. Well, this is on to something a little less confusing.
That's right, I'm going to use the internet to spread unsubstantiated rumors.
Yeah, okay. I guess you heard it here first. I don't know. I don't really know what to make of that.
They heard things here.
I'm definitely going to reserve judgment until I can get some more concrete information. But this week we're talking about the first officers of Star Trek. And I decided to go in an unusual order this time, because I don't want to end up talking about Voyager or Enterprise. I'm tired of doing that. So,
but we have to.
No, we don't.
Because there are first officers in those.
Well, right, but we're not going to end with them.
Oh, okay.
We're gonna do those first. So first, we're going to start with Enterprise, and that is T'Pol, played by Jolene Blalock, which is a hard name for me to pronounce. I always want to say...
What other work has she done?
You know, she's done a little bit of other stuff.
Like, I haven't looked at IMDb. I haven't seen her anything
I else. Saw some of it earlier today when I was doing the research, and I honestly don't remember. She's had a couple of supporting roles in some movies. She's done a couple of other television shows. I think T'Pol is her only, like, sort of big-name gig. And she actually looks way different out of makeup than she does in makeup. Like, I would not recognize her if I just saw her, like, in a convention or on the street. Because, like, her skin tone is completely different. Her hair is actually kind of curly-looking. And she just doesn't look at all the same. So mm-hmm. I was a little surprised by that. But she apparently has some of the more... aside from Dr. Phlox, obviously, she has, I think, the most extensive makeup of anyone in the main cast. Which I guess makes sense, since everyone else in the main cast is human.
Yeah.
but actually, hold on. Let's back up a minute. I forgot there's a little primer we have to do before we talk about the specific ones. Is uh-huh. What is a first officer? because the first officer is very important to the show, and I mean, like, just from a literal standpoint, first officer, you know, is in charge of the ship when the captain's not around, and in general, they serve as like a foil to the captain, and they can, like, they usually provide an alternate or sometimes even opposing point of view when the captain is making their decisions. You know, they oversee the daily running of the ship and such. And so they're in each...
Riker plays with the duty officers.
Yeah, that is something that Riker does. Oh, I'll get to Riker. Riker is actually different than all the other first officers in an interesting way. And sometimes you end up with a situation where the first officer kind of gets overshadowed by the captain if they don't really think through what the first officer's role in the movie is going to be, or movie or episode. And Nemesis is a clear example of that. They made this movie, and they really had no idea what Riker's role in this movie was going to be. So in the end, they send him to fight a monster. And it's like, oh, why is he fighting this monster?
But it was a really rad fight scene.
I would disagree, personally, because they're down in the bottom of the ship, and there's a bottomless pit underneath them. And it's like, where does that pit go?
Well, don't even worry about it being on the Enterprise, or there's a giant pit. It's just a really rad fight scene still.
All right, I guess I can... respect your opinion on that.
If you take the fight scene out of the movie and just watch the fight scene, it's a really cool fight scene.
Maybe. I guess it depends on where we consider the fight scene to begin, because when they're walking down the corridor, like, prior to when the fight starts, they're all just kind of nonchalantly strolling along.
We can talk more about this when we get to Riker.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, so that's the, you know, so that's the first officer's role in the story, is to basically foil as in ruin, the captain. And each first officer has their own way of doing that.
I wonder how much more interesting Star Trek would be if, in fact, that was what the first officer's job was supposed to be, foil the captain.
Well, we'll get a little bit of that. That's sort of what T'Pol was maybe kind of supposed to be, because she's like, you know, T'Pol is a Vulcan during the time period when humans and Vulcans apparently just hated each other, as Enterprise decided. Was that, you know, there was always some kind of...
Well, the Vulcans took a stance of, you guys are not ready to be going to space, and humans are like, well, I mean, we want to go to space.
Right. And, I mean, the whole character of T'Pol is just very strange. Like, it's revealed in later episodes that she was apparently some kind of, like, Vulcan wetworks agent, and she was, like, sent out to retrieve, like, rogue Vulcans, and she, like, killed some of them, and then she had to have like a memory erasing ritual to get rid of that, and I think that comes up in some kind of flashback. But she's also a science officer, which I guess Vulcans live a long time. Maybe they have time to learn different skill sets.
Well, she's only 60 something as far as Vulcans go, if I remember right.
She's not that old for Vulcans, so like I was really surprised to find out that she used to be some kind of assassin. And I was like, wait, when did she have time to go to assassin class and science class? Those aren't really the same skill sets. You know, you have to learn different things. But, I mean, so anyway, I don't really like T'Pol. Because she's from the Vulcans are really bitchy and passive-aggressive period of Vulcans from Enterprise.
Uh-huh.
Because that was what they decided suppressing emotions meant. It's not like Spock, where Spock was literally emotionless and would not, you know, rise to any barbs and would always state things coldly and logically. The Vulcans... in Enterprise are just insulting you under their breath or like, you know, in roundabout ways. And it's just like, really, that's what we decided to go with here. And then her character on top of that doesn't make any sense because it's like, so the Vulcans insisted that they have an observer along with the Enterprise crew.
Right.
But I could never figure out why they decided to make that person the first officer. I was like, cause clearly Archer doesn't trust T'Pol. Neither does anyone else on the crew. And it's like, first officer is a really important job and you're going to give it to the person you don't trust. I mean, granted, the general competency level of the Enterprise crew would suggest that maybe they didn't have anyone qualified for the job, but it just seemed kind of strange. Like, I could understand them being like, okay, as a gesture of goodwill to the Vulcans, we'll let you put someone on the ship to represent Vulcan interests, but that's just a very important position, and I don't really understand why they decided to make...
Well, I think it'd be really silly to put them on there to represent Vulcan interests. The Vulcans have their own, like, fleet. To project their own interests already.
Well, like, but, like, specifically this was about the returning Klang, that's the name of the Klingon, to his homeworld back in Broken Bow. And that does affect, you know, international relations, and that would affect the Vulcans, because the Klingons decided to squash Earth, like a fly on the windshield. The Vulcans would be required to step in, because that was the whole, like, thing that the humans and the Vulcans had going on. And so the Vulcans do have some stake in the outcome of this mission. So it does make sense to me that they would want someone there to make sure that Archer didn't ruin it too badly, especially considering what we see Archer do a little later. But I just, the whole first officer thing was a little strange. And the idea of the first officer and the captain having conflict between them, that's a pretty cool idea. In fact, it's so cool that DS9 and Voyager had already done it by the time Enterprise came along, or at least Voyager tried to do it. Deep Space Nine totally did it, which we'll get to when we get to Kira. But with T'Pol and Archer, I don't really. It's kind of their conflict feels kind of forced because like the whole humans are mad at Vulcans.
There's a lot of prejudice there already.
Yeah, Archer is just painfully racist. Archer just hates Vulcans. He hates them so much, and his reasons for hating them don't make any sense.
Because they're holding humanity back.
It's like, and we've talked about this before, it's not that they're holding humanity back, it's that they're refusing to accelerate them.
Right.
It's not like the Vulcans are going into Earth labs and confiscating their warp technology and being like, you cannot have this.
Oh man, I wish I would have seen that.
That, I mean, that you know, been really if they had decided to do that, that actually could have been kind of interesting if the Vulcans were actively like hindering human space development. That could have been cool. But no, the Vulcans are just refusing to give them technology they haven't come up with themselves. And that is apparently grounds...
Vulcans get medieval with the Prime Directive.
Yeah, and that is just grounds for Archer's hatred of Vulcans. And of course, I think I've said this before, T'Pol is the second worst Vulcan in the universe, the worst Vulcan being T'Pol's mom.
Right.
Who we meet later, and I hate T'Pol's mom so much. Because she's just so bitchy, and I'm just like, you know, guys, this is not what I wanted to remember the Vulcans like. And people sometimes criticize Deep Space Nine for being harsh on Vulcans. I disagree. I think Deep Space Nine showed us that there's more than one kind of Vulcan. Whereas in Enterprise, the Vulcans, except for Ambassador Saval, are all the same. They're all huge assholes. And, like, Ambassador Saval is, like, the only Vulcan in all of Enterprise that I actually think is cool. So that's what they decided to do. And also, I guess they... It was also kind of funny that they made... T'Pol the science officer, because they also don't have any scientists in the human Starfleet. Like, and I guess they were hearkening back to the formula from TOS of the Vulcan science officer, first officer, trying to counterpoint to the somewhat hot-headed human captain. But, the difference being that Kirk is hot-headed because he's awesome, whereas Archer is hot-headed because he's an idiot. And it just doesn't work very well. And I don't know. And that's actually another a trend with first officers that I always find a little strange, is when the first officer has another job in addition to being the first officer. It's like, so the first officer is also your science officer, and it's like, well, doesn't your first officer have a lot of... Don't both of those positions involve a lot of work? Does your first officer really have time to be splitting their duties between running the ship and also dealing with all the scientific information you're gathering? I actually had that same problem with Spock. I thought it was a little weird. Any comments on this, Bob?
I don't think it's really all that weird to have that dual role. Because, I mean, we have other examples of that in Star Trek. For instance, you have Worf, who takes on tactical and security, for instance.
Well, that's true.
Right?
But
So you have those dual roles already coming up. I mean, and then the role of the first officer is to, as we were talking about, provide foil for the captain and then also run the day-to-day operations of the ship. That are kind of more God, I'm having a hard time talking today. It's probably because I've only gotten a few hours of sleep.
That'll do
an administrative role on the ship. For instance, when we see first officers doing first officer things, they're doing like duty officer reviews,
mm-hmm.
right? They're talking about who's going to get a promotion, who's not going to get a promotion. It was what we see Riker and Troy doing, for instance. So I really don't think it's really a huge leap to see the first officer taking on an additional role. And there's another example of that with Matt Decker from Motion Picture.
Oh.
I mean, his circumstance was, unfortunate, really, because...
Wait, hold on. Matt Decker? That's the name of the guy, of the Commodore from Doomsday Machine.
Yes, they're related.
Are they?
Yes.
Okay, I wasn't sure. I thought that maybe that was a coincidence. Sorry, I just watched Doomsday Machine. Keep going.
Funny, actually, I did the other day, too, with Megan. Huh. I sat her down and made her watch it.
It's a good episode. Although, did you notice how it's kind of funny? Because like the Planet Destroyer can only shoot out of that hole in the front, and it turns like a slug. It's like, why doesn't the Enterprise just hover in the back? Because it turns so slowly. I don't imagine they would ever be able to hit them.
I don't know. Special effects. You know how they made that thing, actually?
How did they make that thing?
They took a windsock and dipped it in cement. I'm serious. That's how they made it.
Okay. That's cool. All right.
But like Matt Decker, for instance, you know, he took on the role of first officer when Kirk came down and said, I'm in charge of the Enterprise now with this thing because Starfleet said so. And then he also took on science officer duties before Spock came on board because their original Vulcan science officer was going to come on, died in a horrible transporter accident.
Oh, right. That was funny. Well, I mean, I guess to look at it from a real-world perspective, because you know
which really the lesson there is to never use the energy flower pattern
on the transporter.
But to use either the blue-white one from TNG or the gold one from DOS.
Yeah, don't... Whatever they were doing...
Never flower pattern.
No. But looking at it from a real-world perspective, because you know way more about boats than I do, like, if you have, like, an XO on, like, a ship, is that XO also going to be, like, the helmsman?
Are you talking about, like, the Navy?
I
don't know. I don't know enough about the Navy to tell you that.
All right.
I mean, there's, like, fishing boats, for instance. You have a first mate, but he's typically, you know, also, like, on deck doing stuff, or he could also be the engineer, you know? It's like, those dual roles do exist, you know, in a lot of maritime, you know, industry.
Okay. Well, I don't know. That always kind of weirded me out, but I guess it's not a huge deal. So, talking about things... I guess it wouldn't be fair. There are a couple of things that I do like about T'Pol, in that she, towards, like, in the fourth season, her relation with Trip does get a little bit interesting, in that, like, by the fourth season, Trip has become something more than just kind of an incompetent redneck, and, like, yeah. T'Pol's also gotten a little more interesting. She got to have her, her like, AIDS metaphor story with the mind meld disease, which I thought was kind of neat. And by the fourth season, like, T'Pol's become more like a Vulcan I actually care about. And less, like, a really, really passive-aggressive, like, I don't know, co-worker. So, like, their relationship is kind of cool. And then, of course, there are, I guess, a couple of points during the series where T'Pol points out that Archer's being an idiot. But usually when she does that, it's supposed to be representing that she just isn't, like, open to new ideas. And that Archer is, like, free-thinking and that she's too constrained. And I don't agree. I think that she's right. I think Archer's just a dumbass. But, all right, so it's moving on to Voyager, and we're talking about Commander Chakotay, played by Robert Beltran. And I have to, this character kind of confused me, because the more I found out about him, the more I realized that he's kind of like Cal Hudson from Deep Space Nine. He's like a former Starfleet officer who, like, swaps over to the Maquis to defend his home. He's even got the same rank. And right. For a while, I was like, was this character supposed to be Cal Hudson? Like, did they do a switch? Like, I don't know, that would be the second Voyager character that's based on a character that already existed. The other one being Tom Paris and that cadet. I can never remember his name.
I don't think it was supposed to be that. I think they had the concept and they ran with it is what happened, so.
I guess. Well, I'm like, well, so Chakotay is supposed to be the first officer who has a lot of problems with his captain, right? That was what they were originally pitching because it was like, he's a Maquis guy and he's going to have conflict with Janeway. And then that, of course, never materialized.
He just came off as a yes man to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's like the weird thing is that he very, very rarely opposes any of Janeway's decisions. And when he does, it's weird because he's always the one promoting the nonviolent approach. And it's like, wait, weren't you a resistance fighter terrorist guy? How did you get in that organization?
Let's not confuse resistance fighter with being violent. Let's not associate those two things necessarily together.
Huh? Okay. Well,
I mean, resistance fighters, they can be violent, but they're fighting for freedom, right?
Right.
They're resisting. Now, just because someone's a resistance fighter doesn't mean that as soon as you take them out of that role of being resistance fighter that they're going to go out and fight everything out there.
No.
Just because
but
they're not resisting.
I just mean that, like, Chakotay, by joining the Maquis, has clearly shown that he is okay with using violence as a means to achieve a noble end. And there are many, or not many, but there are at least a couple of episodes, as I recall, where Janeway is the one who's like, we're going to blast them with phasers. And Chakotay's like, we shouldn't do that, because blasting people with phasers is wrong. And it just really feels like the roles are switched. It feels like Chakotay should be the one advocating the more pragmatic but violent strategy, versus Janeway, who with her Starfleet training being like, we have to avoid a fight if we can. I don't know, it just seemed like Chakotay was the one with all the ideals, and Janeway was the one who was, like, wanted to blow stuff up. And I think part of that was just feeding into the fact that Chakotay is Native American. He is so Native American, you would not believe how Native American he is. And it's like that is the part of his character that I really object to the most. Like, he's just bland normally. Like, I'm not really sure what his role in the story is, except when his job is to be Native American. And it's like, wait. So he has dream catchers. Like, when I first saw that, I was like, okay, so he's from, like, some North American tribe. And they were like, nope, his tribe is from South America. And I was like, they got a lot of dream catchers there, don't they? And he's got, like, a wolf.
I honestly don't know.
And he's got, yeah. like, a... No, they don't.
Okay, well, here we go.
Dream catchers are a very strictly North American thing. And he's got what looks like a Maori tattoo, which is supposedly from his tribe. And he's got, like...
Maori, aren't they South?
No, Maori are Pacific Islanders.
They're South Pacific.
Yeah, they're from New Zealand specifically.
Yeah.
And his tattoo looks an awful lot like a Maori tattoo. But supposedly that's from his tribe too. And he goes on these like spirit quests that are very clearly based off of the cultural understanding of what Native Americans come from
North South American Maori land.
See, that's what I thought at first. Well, his culture, he's from like a group of people that have like based their culture off of like an amalgamation of Native Americans. But no, they disproved that. They had an episode specifically about how his people are from the Rubber Tree Tribe, which is an actual tribe, mind you. They exist, and of course they're nothing like Chakotay.
Mm-hmm.
But they established that in the episode Tattoo, which is also the episode where they established that Native Americans were really stupid until they were genetically uplifted by white men from space, which is like one of the most offensive...
I remember that episode.
It's one of the most offensive things I've ever seen on television. And I'm just like, oh my god, guys, did you really do that? Why? He's like every Native American tradition ever, and I don't really understand what they were going for with that. And he's just... Oh my god, I don't know. I was kind of hoping at some point that someone would ask him about his tattoo and what its significance was, and he's like, no, this isn't a tattoo from my tribe. This is a Maori tattoo that I thought looked cool. What?
I so wanted to be that now.
That's what I was really hoping it would be, but no, they showed him getting the goddamn tattoo. They showed his father getting the damn tattoo from the tribe that they found. Because at one point, like, they go to a flashback and he's going back to South America on Earth and finds some people, some rubber tree people, who they actually refer to as the rubber people, which makes them sound silly. I don't know why they didn't use their actual name, but they didn't. And they find some of those guys who are still hanging out in the jungle, living traditionally, like, the idea being that there's some kind of lost tribe, which strikes me as extremely unlikely in the 24th century, but whatever. And we see Chakotay's father getting that tattoo, the implication being that he decided to get it later because of his father. And I don't know, they completely ruined that. Actually, Robert Beltran said something kind of funny in one of his interviews. He was like, I was really hoping that at some point later in the show, the captain or the doctor would look at my tattoo and say, that's it, that's the map to Earth. Robert Beltran is actually really funny.
that would have been great.
Well, Robert Beltran and also Jolene Blalock? Yeah, Jolene Blalock. They are both very outspoken critics of the shows they were in. And I was like, wow, I cannot imagine why.
Yep.
I was like, good on you guys. You know shit when you see it.
That's the map to Earth.
I think that would have been funny, personally. And I actually thought about it, and I've decided that Chakotay was actually worse than T'Pol. Because
really?
T'Pol was annoying, but at least I wouldn't ever describe her as being bland. Whereas Chakotay is just boring. Like, you could honestly replace Chakotay with, like an extra, and most of the time you would never notice the difference. Like, there are a number of episodes where Chakotay barely has any lines. Like, he has one line to fulfill, or two, to fulfill his contract. And then he's just barely in the episode. There are so few episodes about Chakotay. And then there was that one episode, I can't remember.
More often than not, I find Chakotay is just serving more or less as a conduit for the rest of the Maquis crew.
Yeah, kind of.
Season one Maquis crew is all about, I don't want to be Starfleet. Arrgh.
Well, you would think that, but that only actually happens like 3 times. And like there was that one scene in I can't remember the name of the episode, but the scene where like Janeway is trying to incorporate like the last 4 like Maquis holdouts into the crew, and Chakotay like punches one of them to bring him in line. I was like, why can't you do that more often? Like, that's so cool. Come
just
on, guys.
Just go around punching people.
Or just, you know, be generally a little bit more of a badass, because the whole point of the Maquis, like that Maquis story, was that the Maquis don't have the same discipline as Starfleet does. So the idea is that you have to exert much more personal authority to get things done. You can't just depend on your rank. Because like in Starfleet, you can pretty much assume that an ensign is going to follow a lieutenant's orders, even if he doesn't personally like the lieutenant, mm-hmm. because he's been through the academy, he's been trained to follow orders and respect the chain of command. Whereas the Maquis don't really have that. Most of the Maquis were never in Starfleet, and they don't have that kind of military discipline. So Chakotay would have to be able to project authority to get people to listen to him. But he doesn't really seem to be able to most of the time. Like, that's really one of the only instances I can ever think of where Chakotay actually projected something that would make people listen to him. And there was that one episode, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was the one where they found, like, the old Earth spaceship that had been sucked into, like, the traveling plasma thing.
You know what I want now? Mm-hmm. I want a demotivational poster that's got Chakotay punching the guy saying projecting authority.
Oh, man. I'll see if I can make that happen. We can put it up as an extra on our website. It'll be pretty rad. But I keep trying to mention this one episode, and I want to say it before we move on.
Okay.
Is the episode where there's the big flying plasma dimension thing. It's like this big orange ball, and it like sucked up the first Mars Explorer ship.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't remember the name of the episode.
It was like Chakotay's childhood hero or something.
Yeah, and Chakotay was really obsessed with getting it, and I was like, even though that episode is really silly, I was so happy, because Chakotay was finally interested in something that had nothing to do with being an Indian. And I was like, cool. So Native American
projecting authority.
Native American people can have interests other than other things that are Native American. That's kind of cool. I'm glad they decided to go with that. I really don't know what they were thinking with the Chakotay character. I think that they were. I mean, I've heard this theory forwarded before, and I think it's pretty accurate. Is that they introduced Chakotay as someone who would challenge Janeway's authority, but then they were afraid to have him actually do that because they didn't want to be sexist. They were worried that if they actually had Janeway's authority be challenged, everyone would be yelling at them about not respecting their first female captain. And I think as a result, they just had everyone in the crew would just like immediately jump on the Janeway bandwagon the moment she would suggest something. And there are like a couple of instances where that isn't true, like in Scorpion and in Equinox, Chakotay, like, finds his testicles somewhere and, like, says, Janeway, this is a bad idea. But in neither of those episodes does he ever actually really do anything about it. I guess in Scorpion, he does break the alliance with the Borg, but only after Janeway is unconscious. Which I find, I don't know, that strikes me as a little, I'd say, cowardly. It's like, so I think this is a bad idea. I am so convinced this is a bad idea that I will break the captain's orders, but not when she's around. I'm gonna wait till she's unable to contradict me, and then I will break her.
Well,
she was
unconscious. How was she unconscious exactly? What was the circumstance around that?
I think she was knocked out in a Species 8472 attack. I could be wrong.
Okay.
But I think that's what happened. And then,
I mean, it's the duty of the first officer to do what he thinks is best for the ship.
Right.
He thought the alliance with the Borg was a bad idea, and it turned out to be a bad idea.
Right, but if he was...
It advanced Voyager's agenda of getting home, getting through space and whatnot, but I mean, as we see later, it just caused like a wave of terror.
I feel like if Chakotay was that opposed to the Alliance that he was willing to break it the moment Janeway wasn't around to say that he couldn't, even though he knew that Janeway would be upset at him for breaking the Alliance, which she was when she woke up, I feel like, really, he should have just refused to be part of it. He should have said, I will not do this, Captain. This is wrong. Because at that point, I mean, that's effectively what he did. He just did it in a very passive-aggressive way. I don't know. And then there's he's a little bit better in Equinox, where he, like, actually does stop Janeway from straight-up murdering a prisoner. And I don't know, maybe Janeway was counting on him to do that, or maybe she's just really crazy, but that part was at least kind of cool.
Janeway is pretty incensed throughout Equinox, from what I remember.
Yeah, she's really, really mad. Of course, that's the same episode where Voyager somehow gets its butt kicked by, like, a little science vessel that's already been really heavily damaged. So there's a sequence where they're chasing the Equinox, and the Equinox just, like, turns around and punches them in the nose. And, like, you know, they actually have, like, a firefight with the Equinox, and somehow the Equinox wins and runs off. And I'm like, the Equinox is, like, half the size of Voyager, has way fewer weapons.
No, it's because they replaced the EMH, and the EMH gave them an advantage.
Is that what happened?
Yes.
I don't remember...
Because an Intrepid class would totally wipe the floor with a Nova any day of the week.
Right, but I don't remember that happening. Like, I watched it pretty recently.
So EMH Equinox ran into EMH Voyager,
mm-hmm.
or I'm just going to call him the Doctor.
Right.
Right, ran into the Doctor, saw a mobile emitter, asked about mobile emitter,
right.
then promptly confiscated from mobile emitter.
Yeah, okay, I remember that. I remember them switching places.
And then through happenstance, the Voyager crew runs into the EMH from the Equinox, who has the mobile emitter, bring him back to Voyager, and now he's on board Voyager, where he causes enough...
What does he do to make Voyager lose that fight?
Oh, I don't remember exactly, but it was enough to you know... allow the Equinox to turn around, punch him in the nose like you're saying, and run away.
I don't even remember that. I'll have to look at that episode again, because I remember being really confused when that fight went down.
Equinox EMH had its, what was it, the, like, ethical subroutines deleted or something.
Yeah, which is weird, because, like, my brother actually pointed this out. When they delete the EMH's ethical subroutines, it, like, makes it... It basically... He still follows the orders of his captain and his crew, but now he's... okay with doing things that should be wrong, right? But right. when they do the same thing to the Voyager EMH, suddenly he just does whatever they tell him, like the with the Equinox crew, whereas that isn't what happens with the Equinox EMH, which suggests that the Voyager doctor just hates the Voyager crew so much that the only thing stopping him from going on a mad rampage are his ethical subroutines. That's kind of an interesting... my brother brought that up, and I thought that was really funny. But okay, so we drifted really, really far away from Chakotay.
That's how bland and uninteresting
Yeah, that's
he
how
is.
Bland he is. It's hard to find interesting things to say about him. All right, so...
Well, we better move on to the next person.
We're going to move on. All right, William Riker.
Yay!
Woo! Bob really likes William Riker.
I'm a Riker fan.
All right, Bob, tell us why you like Riker. Tell us about him.
Because he is a legit Starfleet first officer.
Mm-hmm.
He's carrying out his duties,
yeah.
you know, as he needs to be. He was selected, you know, in true executive officer, you know, selection fashion, which is Picard was looking at, you know, applications and whatnot. I said, I like this guy, put him in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is how that worked. Then he's, you know, actually got Starfleet ambitions, you know. It's like, I like being able to see, you know, Starfleet officer characters carrying on with their career.
Yeah, I that is one thing I really like about Riker, is that he's the only... First
off, and there's actually some of that, you know, catharsis in Nemesis when he's like, you know, yeah, I'm going to go take the Titan. Then you read the Titan books and he causes, you know, misery and destruction wherever he goes.
Destroyer of worlds. But that's one thing I like about Riker, is he is the only first officer from the Star Trek series that doesn't have some kind of weird backstory. Like everyone else, they all have some kind of strange, unusual backstory, whereas Riker is just, he is an above average highly competent command officer. He's not like some ex-freedom fighter or like a weird hybrid or anything like that. He's a guy. He really strikes me as, you know, just a human dude who's good at his job.
Yep.
Now, unfortunately, the fact that he doesn't have any weird stuff going on the side means there are a number of times when he's kind of overshadowed, because when it's time to make the big decisions, Picard is the one making them, usually. And there are a couple of episodes where that's not true. Best of Both Worlds is very notable. We talked about that already.
Where there is no Picard.
Yeah, Picard's not around. And there are a couple of other episodes.
The Vengeance Factor.
And there are a couple of other episodes where it is about Riker and his decisions. But it seems like Riker is definitely not one of the more developed characters on TNG, in my opinion. Because it seems like there are just a number of instances where Riker's just like, you know, he just goes along with what Picard says. And that's because Picard is a very good captain, and there's not really any reason for Riker to object to his decisions. Unlike,
except when Picard clone wants to put the ship into a pulsar, and Riker's like, that's not the thing we should do.
No,
we're not going to do that, in fact.
We're not going in there.
We're not going in there.
It would be hilarious if we redid that episode and was Picard operating under some kind of like super secret Starfleet intelligence mission, and there was actually like a base in there. I don't know.
In a pulsar?
I don't know. They put bases in weird places.
A pulsar.
Yeah, a pulsar. I just thought that would be funny.
Okay.
But, you know, that's definitely true. There are certain episodes where he does get to step up, but I think that he overall doesn't have a huge amount of development. I would have liked to see more. And I do like his relationship with Troy, even though I don't like Troy herself, personally. But I do like their relationship.
I think Riker got a good bit of development through the series.
I feel like he could have...
I mean, every season, you know, tried to sprinkle a little bit for each character in, but it definitely, the progression for Riker was very early on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, Best of Both Worlds is kind of as good as it gets, really.
Yeah.
You know, or season three really is kind of as good as it gets for Riker. Because after that, we certainly don't see a lot more development for him. I mean, we have the... Oh, what's it called? The one that was the gay rights analogy.
Oh, I don't remember the name.
The Outcast, is that right?
Yeah, that episode is kind of weird.
I mean, we see that one. I don't think there are many after that. I mean, we see situations where Riker's stepping up and being like, hey, we need to do these things, you know, to make sure that things go right. Like Descent, for instance, where he's, you know, coordinating with the Borg resistance.
Right.
But I really think that Riker did get good development for the screen time that was available. Because we have 7 seasons, and a lot of the development for other characters takes place later on. Like, you know, Crusher still gets some. Worf definitely gets quite a bit of it. Troy, sort of later on.
No. There is one episode.
Troy episodes. But,
There was
one good one, which is Thine Own Self, which she got.
What happens in that one?
That's the one where she's taking the bridge officer test.
No, because that's a stupid test. I reject that. That's false.
That's not a stupid test.
It's a stupid test. It's like the whole point of that test is, can you send someone to their death? But yeah, that's not actually what it's testing, because she knows it's not real. The answer, that's not actually testing if she can send someone to her death.
No, because all of her Starfleet training up to that point is telling her that she needs to be able to seek out all the alternatives or no one dies. And that's the ultimate test, in fact, for someone who is in a position of command. That's something that goes on today and has been in, you know, naval tradition and military tradition for hundreds of years, whether or not you can order someone to die to save everyone else.
Right, but I feel like that test is more, it shows that you are clever enough to figure out that that's the solution, but it doesn't actually show whether or not you have the nerves to do it in a real-life situation. Because, like, I mean, you know, I knew what the answer was. I was watching that, and I knew the answer was to send Geordi to die. But I know personally that if I was in that situation, I could never send one of my friends to die to save the rest of them. I just couldn't do it. I'd be like, no, I would hesitate, and that would cause everyone to die, which is why I am not command material.
Good job, Warren. You killed us all.
Granted, I haven't been through any training courses or anything. Maybe eventually I could become that. But the point is that being able to figure out that that's the solution does not equal being able to do it in real life, which is why I find the test to be kind of silly. It would work if it had been like the test with Wesley, where he thought it was real. Like if, you know, if they transported Troy into the holodeck one day while she was asleep, and then she woke up and was in command and had to send someone to their death and thought it was real. Now that would have worked. Now granted, maybe that would have been psychologically scarring. I don't know. But
yeah.
But okay, we're not talking about Troy.
But well, my point being is that Riker still does get good development, but not as much. I mean, because Riker's one of my favorite characters. You know, mm-hmm. Obviously, I would like to see more Riker episodes, but it's just not in the, you know, the available screen time for him to get more is the thing.
Apparently, Jonathan Frakes proposed a Star Trek series of his own after Enterprise ended.
The Rikers in Space.
No, it was a serious one. It wasn't the Rikers in Space.
The Rikers in Space. It would be Following Titan.
But I thought, wasn't that like a joke that they did? Like they were talking about like a sitcom?
No.
Really?
Okay. It's like a legit thing that he wants to do.
Oh, well, I'm a little confused because I thought the Rikers in Space was something that Maurice Surtees and Jonathan Frakes were like bullshitting about on like an interview, and it was going to be like a comedy sitcom.
Well, no, right? They've mentioned it numerous times when they've been interviewed that they'd love to go on and do this thing, which is, you know, Following Titan.
Okay, well, maybe that's what he was talking about. I guess I may have been...
It's been referred to as Rikers in Space because they're married. The characters are married.
Okay.
You know?
So they're not talking
about... It's the Rikers in Space.
Well, because the one time I heard them talking about it, it sounded like they were joking. Because they were describing this very comedic and sort of absurd situation. And I was like, huh, that doesn't sound like a show. But maybe they were... I guess I haven't heard of it.
I think they were just explaining it in a way that was humorous, just in the same way, like, when you and I are talking and we're mentioning something, we greatly simplify whatever the concept is and say something that makes it sound stupid.
Okay, well, that's fair. All right. So anyway, you have anything more to say about Riker?
He's rad.
Okay.
I want more Riker.
That's good. Well, read the Titan books. He can destroy some worlds for you.
Yep.
All right, so next up we have Kira Nerys from Deep Space Nine, who is my personal favorite. And I think I've mentioned why on the show a couple of times. You know, and she, again, she's one of the ones that has, like, a weird backstory where she used to be, like, a resistance fighter. And she's what T'Pol and Chakotay were both trying to be and failed. And that she is a first officer who actually has a conflict with her commanding officer. And she has a real reason to be on the ship, because, like, Sisko specifically requested a Bajoran first officer because he wanted to be like, hey, let's be friends with the Bajorans and not just, you know, be another occupying force.
Yep. Let's do some nation building.
Yeah, let's build trust. And of course, the Bajorans sent him someone who they didn't want to deal with anymore. And they have it's to some extent, Kira and Sisko have two different agendas. Like, they both, in the long term, want what's best for Bajor, but they clearly have different ideas of what that is. And the first season, especially, they butt heads on numerous occasions. But at the same time, I think that they have a much more realistic relationship than, like, say, Archer and T'Pol, because Archer, really, in the episode, what's the name of the episode where they go to Pajem? I can't remember the name of it.
I don't know, but I know what you're talking about. The one where they go there.
The Andorian incident, that's what it's called.
Oh, there we go.
After that episode, T'Pol should really have just left, because that was Archer giving the giant middle finger to the Vulcans and, like, destabilizing the entire region on his, like, personal quest. And T'Pol, at that point, with her logic, should have realized how dumb that was, and there is no way they should have been able to work together after that. Especially because
T'Pol ended up siding with Archer, didn't she?
Yeah, she did. And really, she shouldn't have, because in that episode, Archer basically orders her to betray her own people and do something that he knows.
Well, they got caught in a lie, though. They very much got caught in a lie.
Right.
Right? Because, I mean, Pajem, which is supposed to be this monastery that's dedicated to Vulcan logic, all this stuff or whatever, right? You know, it's sitting there, all innocent-like, and what's underneath it? A whole, like, spy surveillance network.
Right, but the reason...
I mean, you look at the facility, it's fucking huge.
Right. But the reason that Archer chooses to reveal all that to the Andorians and give them the proof that they need is because
sticking it to the Vulcans.
He thinks that spying is wrong. Like, he's made a moral judgment that spying is wrong, but from a logical perspective, that spy array fulfills a very important purpose of making sure the Vulcans know what this extremely aggressive species on their border is up to. And logically, T'Pol should know that that was a bad decision, because that will hurt Vulcan, and it will probably hurt Earth in the long term as well. And it has the potential to start a war. And this is all because Archer decided to go with a very dogmatic approach to morality and decide lying is wrong. It doesn't matter why they do it. The fact that they were lying means that they are in the wrong, and they have to, you know, and they have to pay for that. And really, that was an emotional decision that Archer made that T'Pol should have been like, nah, that's no bueno. You cannot do that, sir. Especially because, and that was like, I mean, we've seen Vulcans, particularly Spock, in that situation before. But I'm sorry, we've drifted way off. I was talking about Kira and how Kira and Sisko have a relationship that, although it has tension in it, it's their goals are similar enough that they can eventually learn to work together. Whereas it really feels like T'Pol and Archer never should have been able to. And like, Janeway and Chakotay, I could see them eventually learning to work together because of their, you know, they're both stuck in the Delta Quadrant. Of course, they learned to work together right off the bat. They had no problems.
Chakotay, yes, man.
Whereas Kira manages to strike the neat middle ground. And then even beyond that, she's also just a very interesting character. And she has, like, enough stuff going on in her backstory that she never suffers from the problem that I perceived Riker having. And obviously, I think Bob probably disagrees with me on this one. But I felt that Riker had the problem of sometimes just sort of sliding into Picard's shadow. And I never felt like Kira had that problem with Sisko. Because Kira has her own stuff going on. And dramatically, she is on a much different track than Sisko is. I also like Kira because she's one of the only religious characters in all of Star Trek. And, you know, I think that that's kind of neat. And I wish that we'd gone more into it even. Because, like, there's a whole lot of... The idea of having your gods exist as actual aliens is like a whole level of complexity. I've heard some people dismiss it as being like, well, that completely defeats the point of faith because you know your gods are hanging out right there. But I think it actually is way deeper than that, because you have to like think about, well, okay, so first of all, are these creatures actually the prophets? Like, are they? I don't know. Second of all, since we know that they're there and that they have this tremendous power, why didn't they stop the occupation? You have to be able to have faith.
Are you talking about the difference between saying that they're there or that there's substantial evidence saying that they're there?
Well, knowing that they're there because you've seen them in the wormhole.
Okay.
Yeah. And like,
I mean, the Greeks had Mount Olympus, and they said everything was hanging out Mount Olympus, for instance, and they believed that they were there.
Right, and there are a number of religions that have physical locations that they say that the gods hang out on. But, like, it requires a different kind of faith once your gods are tangible, like, you know, interactable creatures. People. That start doing stuff, and you have to,
shooting lasers,
you know,
on the promenade.
Because once you've taken them out of the realm of the theoretical and into actually just doing things, at that point it stops becoming an abstract idea and becomes, you know, do you believe that they're doing this for, do they have a plan? Is this going to come out for the good of Bajor? Like, why didn't, you know, do you have faith in them despite the fact that they stood by and did nothing during the occupation? Like, these are all very important questions. And we didn't really ever get too deeply into it. I think maybe because that would have been a little too, like, I don't know, that would have been maybe a little too
edgy for
Star
Trek. Well,
sort of.
I mean,
you've
got some people who turned to the Pa race, for instance, later on because they felt the prophets, you know, didn't do anything.
You do? Although that only came up after, like, T'Kot closed the wormhole with his magic Pa Wraith beams.
Yep.
So, like, that was sort of a very direct result. There wasn't a whole lot of intellectual thought going on there. Or I didn't feel like there was. But, I would have liked to see more of that with Kira. And I just really like Nana Visitor. I really like her her acting. Apparently, she went with the, some actors do this. She went, when she went to her audition, she did the whole thing in character. Not just the actual reading, but, like, you know, talking to the people at the door, afterwards. You know, she was in character the whole time.
Oh my goodness.
Well, that's the thing that some actors do. Like, the guy who plays Vic Fontaine, he did the same thing. And it's, I like the idea.
I really just have this image of her being very unpleasant to everybody.
Well,
really.
that's what happened. Apparently, her after that, the casting people were like, well, she's perfect for the role, but I don't know if we can work with her. This is apparently a thing that happened. And I was trying to think of some stuff about Kira that I didn't like, and really, the only thing I could think of was that I wasn't too fond of the way they handled the pregnancy story arc, which obviously they had to do somehow because Nana Visitor was pregnant.
Right.
And I also don't like the fact that she wears heels, which is more of a height thing, I feel, because, like, you don't really, very rarely do they ever show shots of anyone's feet on television.
Actually, I had this discussion with Megan the other day.
Really?
About heels, yeah. And we were out shopping for new boots for her, is what it was. And we were, like, at the shoe store, and you're looking at boots and whatnot. And she pulls out these boots that have, like, these really tall heels on them. Yeah, I'm like, there's no way you're going to be able to walk in snow with those. Because this is when we were having all the snow happen, right?
Right.
Up here in Seattle. And, but she's like, but they look so cool. I'm like, that's great. But they're not going to be functional.
Well, I mean, Kira's heels.
Like, I accept that women want to wear heels. That's fine. They want to wear heels, more power to them. If they feel like, you know, that's something that makes them taller, that empowers them, or whatever it is, whatever the reasoning is, whether it's a fashion statement or height, whatever it might be, that's great. But please understand that heels are not functional shoes. They're form shoes.
Well, I've never met a woman who thought that heels were functional shoes. I think everyone I know who wears heels, be they man or woman, understands that they are there to make you look cooler, as opposed to because they are awesome for running around in. And that's why I was a little annoyed by the fact that Kira wears heels, is because she is in a military position where she occasionally has to be able to get places quickly, especially on unstable surfaces, and it's,
well,
like,
she didn't wear heels early on.
Well, I don't know if she did.
And
or
later
not.
On, when because initially it was actually, I noticed as part of the uniform change for them, because initially they had the really kind of heavy padded shoulders going on, right?
Yeah.
And she was wearing normal boots at that point, but later on, when the uniform became slimmer, far more form fitting, that's when the heels kicked in.
Is it? I don't know, because, like, I don't remember people's feet unless they're something specifically strange about them. So I'll buy that. And
that may actually be, in fact, maybe a commentary on how she changed her attitude in a physical representative way from being the soldier combative individual that we see early on in the series to being much more of a form conscious administrative forward-thinking individual.
It's possible. I think they just needed her to be taller. And sometimes the camera had to show her feet. I think that was just what it was, personally. But I would have preferred if they had had some way to do that without showing her wearing heels. Other than that, I mean, I don't know. I really like Kira Nerys, and I especially, you know, her relationship with the Cardassians is really interesting, and especially with, like, Gul Dukat. and her whole and her. I do like her romance with Odo. I know some people don't, but I enjoyed it. I thought it worked out pretty well. And Deep Space Nine also has, I think the only good romance in Star Trek. Oh no, that's not true. I do like the Tom Paris Torres relationship. I think that was a good boost for the show, even if it did kind of come out of nowhere.
I felt that relationship was a little more real. Personally,
which one?
Torres Paris one.
Then Kira Odo.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, given the fact that these characters, I mean, accepting the fact that these characters are kind of extremes, mind you, Torres being, you know, angry a lot, and then
yeah.
Paris being probably one of the most childish man-childs ever.
Yes, this is, like, a fact.
I mean, but those are real things still, you know, to where woman gets annoyed that guy is doing, you know, things that are, you know, immature or childish or so, forgetting things, you know, or dates anyway.
Well, why did you feel that Kira-Odo relationship wasn't real?
I didn't say it wasn't real. I thought that the Paris Torres one was more real.
Because they have, like, more problems?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's fair. To be fair to the Kira-Odo relationship, it doesn't really come up until,
I mean,
like...
The Kira-Odo one would definitely be more reflective of, like, if I had to compare it to a relationship that was nowadays, is workplace romance, where the guy, you know, in this case, you know, was like the 40-year-old virgin, and had no no previous relation, like, experience at all, because that's very much how Odo comes off. You know, it's like they have a disagreement initially about something where Odo had arrested a Vedic or something for not having, like, a proper permit, and then he thinks it's, like, over between him and Kira, like, altogether,
right,
because she's mad at him.
Right. Well, to be fair...
Like, Megan gets mad at me for things, but just because of that doesn't mean we're not engaged anymore.
Well, to be fair, I think the Odo-Kira relationship, they don't have a whole lot of problems, I think, partially because that relationship starts, like, halfway through the seventh season. So, like, for them, they're still in the sort of the opening high of the relationship when everything is, like, love and flowers, and they don't really get into the long-term, you know, pack out your dirty laundry phase, which we do get to see Torres and Paris go through. So there is that. But okay, so enough about romance. I might actually have an episode specifically about romance in Star Trek later.
Ooh.
But now we're going to talk about the Holy Grail of Starfleet First Officers, and it's I think the best one overall, even though he's the oldest, and that would be Spock from TOS.
Now, there's only one point where he's called the best First Officer.
Really?
Yes, and that is in Operation Annihilate by McCoy.
Which episode is that?
It's where they go to Deneba 4, I think is what it is. They're noticing that there's, like, all these plants that are, all their population has been wiped out or so, and they have this space vomit parasites.
Right, the ones that look like big old amoebas.
Yeah.
Right, okay, I remember that episode. Yeah, that I...
Where we see Kirk's brother, but it's just Kirk with a mustache.
Really?
I'm serious, yeah, it's Kirk with a mustache.
I've completely forgotten about that. I didn't realize Kirk had a brother. Are they supposed to be twins?
No, they're not twins. I don't know who the elder one is, though. But the only reason I know that is because, because I rewatched the episode recently. And two, for Christmas, my parents had gotten me this really thick, like, it's a book on all the Star Trek, the original series episodes and little trivia and whatnot that's in there. And one of the bits of trivia is, in fact, Kirk's brother was played by William Shatner. They just put a mustache on him.
Yeah, that's funny. All right, well, so the thing about Spock. I think Spock, the reason he works so well as a first officer is partially just because of Leonard Nimoy. There are a couple of seasons early on, a couple of episodes early where it's clear that Leonard Nimoy is still sort of finding his feet with the role of Spock. Like, in the first couple episodes, he shouts a lot, which is just not something you think of Spock doing. Like, if you think of Spock, you cannot imagine him shouting,
mm-hmm.
except because there's too much noise in the room and he needs to be heard.
Right.
But there are several episodes where Spock gets visibly excited and shouts, but he outgrows that pretty quick,
mm-hmm.
And he really falls into the role. And, of course, Leonard Nimoy brings so much to the Vulcans. Leonard Nimoy is the one who came up with the live long and prosper sign.
The slew, the Vulcan pinch.
Yeah, the nerve pinch, the fact that, like, and Spock is just, I don't know, he's very intellectual. Like, he does recognize that occasionally violence is required, but he always exhausts every option before violence. When he engages in violence, it's never, like, brutish or, like, unrefined, which is where the whole nerve pinch thing comes from, because they were originally going to have him bash a guy in the head with a phaser. And Nimoy's like, no, I don't really think Spock would do that. That's very, like, that's very, very angry and very brutal for Spock. So they came up with this other thing for him to do, which I thought was neat. And again, I just watched Doomsday Machine, which is a really great Spock episode. And it's like, it just shows, you know, it shows both the strengths and weaknesses of the Spock character, because Spock is clearly very competent, very intelligent, but because he's very rigid in his thinking, he cannot just say, fuck off,
He can't say no to Decker.
Yeah, exactly. He can't just say, fuck off, Commander Decker, or Commodore Decker, because the regulations say that you have to obey the superior officer, whereas a human in this instance, especially Kirk, would realize that Decker is being crazy and just relieve him of duty. And the bridge crew clearly would have followed him if he'd done that.
Uh-huh.
And eventually Spock does say, Commodore, you're about to commit suicide. I can relieve you on that. But he waits until the Commodore has already put the ship in danger, and that shows the weakness of being too rigid in your thinking. And so it's, you know, I really like that. I think that's a really neat dynamic that Spock has. And of course, Spock just has amazing chemistry with Kirk and McCoy both. That's just like, you know, they're called the Big Three for a reason.
Yep.
And they have like a great dynamic going on. And then there's a little, and there's more depth to Spock. He's like he's the only one of any of the crew that really has much of a backstory in TOS. Because he has his half Vulcan ancestry, and we see some of his conflicts with his father, and get hinted at that he had a troubled childhood on Vulcan, which we saw a little bit more of in the more recent movie. And I don't know, I think to me he's easily the best first officer, even though I personally like Kira more, just because I'm a huge softie for Deep Space Nine. I feel like from an objective standpoint, Spock sets the bar incredibly high. And I would like to see more of that. I don't know. I'll be interested to see where they decide to go with the Spock in the new movies, and if we ever see another television series, I'd be interested to see what they do with the next first officer. But, like, I think that it's going to be hard to follow Spock, and partially because Leonard Nimoy is just a great actor.
Yeah, I have a really hard time taking the original series and kind of trying to analyze it in a military sense, I guess you could say,
mm-hmm.
because of the way that the narrative unfolds. Like, obviously, they still have a chain of command, and so, like, Kirk is the captain, and there's all the bridge officers that are under him, and all that stuff, right?
Right, right.
But the way the story unfolds a lot of the time is much more about, well, not about, but you see much more of the friendship aspects of, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy come out and play parts in the story, as opposed to we're in this situation and here's how we're going to solve the situation, and it's done in a very chain of command, military type kind of way, like you see in TNG and later.
Yeah, well, that's true. They definitely,
you know, as it's been said like numerous times, the original series is much more like Horatio Hornblower in space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's much more that way about it. So I have a hard time saying that Spock is a great first officer, because he acts much more like a loyal friend as opposed to a first officer.
That's an interesting take on it, and you're right. TOS definitely has much more of the, we're going to beam down, it'll be the captain, the first officer, and the chief medical officer, and
yep.
some ensign that no one's ever heard of. So yeah, that's definitely a thing. I can totally see where you're coming from.
Yeah, he's a fantastic friend, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's very loyal to, you know, Kirk and McCoy. Still has an understanding of duty, but he doesn't let that dude necessarily interfere with his relationship, as we've seen numerous times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not only, you know, from Spock to the crew, but also vice versa.
See,
you
know, I
Star Trek 3, anybody?
Oh boy, Star Trek 3. I never would have thought of that. That's an interesting take on it, is that, and I think that definitely in the later Star Treks, they realize,
you know, it's like their camaraderie just kind of transcends the whole idea of chain of command, I think.
Yeah, and I think that in the later Star Treks, they realized that an organization like Starfleet isn't just a bunch of friends palling around through the galaxy. Like, they have procedures and stuff, whereas in TOS, they don't really, their procedures are not very well thought out.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I could argue in some early TNG, they had the same problem. But, anyway, I think that's about all we got. You have anything more to add to Spock? All right. Well, thank you all for listening. And next week, I would like to talk about the Star Trek RPG. I want to discuss it in
depth. Well, maybe. That'll depend upon the Starbase UGC guys.
I completely forgot. I am such a pro. Hopefully next week we're going to be talking about Starbase UGC.
Yeah, which we're probably going to be talking about the Star Trek Online and the Foundry and its greater impact on the Star Trek franchise.
Definitely. All right. Well, until then, this is All Things Trek signing off. Thank you for listening to All Things Trek. This show is distributed under a Creative Commons 3.0 license, which means please share it, but don't change it or sell it. Remember, resistance is futile.